Life is not fair. I'm sure you're saying, tell me something I don't already know. So read the newspapers, watch the evening news. Just take a look around, and you might come to this conclusion. Just so many things about life that are unexpected and seemingly very unfair. Max Lucado writes, may I gently but firmly remind you of something you may know but may have forgotten. Life is not fair. That's not pessimism, it's a fact. It's not a complaint, it's just the way things are. I don't like it, neither do you. We want life to be fair. Ever since the kid down the block got the bike and we didn't, we've been saying the same old thing. It's not fair. But at some point, someone needs to say to us, whoever told you that life was going to be fair? God didn't. In fact, he didn't say if you have many kinds of troubles. He said when you have many kinds of troubles. Troubles are part of the package. And when life doesn't seem to be fair, many people wonder where God is. They might not say it as such, but it's easy for the mind to move from life is not fair to God is not fair. Or they may conclude that if God didn't cause this calamity, he must be either unconcerned about it or unable to do anything about it. But is it really that simple? Is God really that unfeeling, unable to understand how we feel when life is not fair? As we continue through our journey through the Gospel of John, we've come to John chapter 18. And our text this morning would seem to indicate otherwise. If you have your Bibles, turn to John chapter 18. Last week we considered the first section of this chapter, which dealt with the arrest of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Our text this morning is actually two different parts of the chapter, because John intersperses the trial of Jesus in with the denials by Peter, which we're going to look at next week. So we're going to begin with verses 12 through 14 and then jump down to verses 19 through 24. Then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it would be good if one man died for the people. Meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. I have spoken openly to the world, Jesus replied. I always taught in synagogues or at the temple, where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby struck him in the face. Is that the way you answer the high priest? He demanded. If I said something wrong, Jesus replied, testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me? Then Annas sent him, still bound, to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now this is as far as John goes, but if we go to Matthew chapter 26, we pick up the narrative at that point, beginning in verse 59. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so they could put him to death. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward and declared, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. Then the high priest, again Caiaphas, stood up and said to Jesus, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? But Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Yes, it is as you say, Jesus replied. But I say to all of you, in the future, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? They answered, He is worthy of death. Now, those of you that are familiar with the events of Passion Week leading up to the death and resurrection of Jesus are probably familiar with that story. But what you may not know is that the gospel accounts of Jesus' arrest and these trials demonstrate that most, if not all, of the rules of Jewish jurisprudence were blatantly ignored. Here's just a sample of some of the laws that were broken in these trials of Jesus. First, no trials were to occur during the night hours. You could not have a nighttime trial according to the Jewish law. Trials were not to occur on the eve of a Sabbath or during a festival. This was the eve of the Passover. All trials were to be public. Secret trials were forbidden, but this was a secret trial. All trials were to be held in the hall of judgment in the temple area. But John and Matthew both record that these took place first at the home of Annas, then at the home of Caiaphas. Capital cases required a minimum of 23 judges. Here we only see of one. An accused person could not testify against himself. I'm sure you're all familiar with our Fifth Amendment, that you cannot be forced to incriminate yourself. They had a form of that back then. But yet, Caiaphas, because he couldn't get any of his false witnesses to agree on anything, had Jesus declare his own guilt in his mind. Someone was required to speak on behalf of the accused, but yet nobody stood up to speak for Jesus. Conviction required the testimony of two or three witnesses to be in perfect alignment. And it's very clear through the Gospels that they could not get their witnesses to agree. Witnesses for the prosecution were to be examined and cross-examined extensively, and there was no cross-examination because Jesus had no legal representation. Capital cases were to follow a strict order, beginning with arguments by the defense, then arguments for conviction. Didn't happen here. All Sanhedrin judges could argue for acquittal, but not all could argue for conviction. How about this one? The high priest was not to participate in the questioning. Who's the only one that did? Caiaphas. Each witness in a capital case was to be examined individually, not in the presence of other witnesses. And yet that wasn't followed here. The testimony of two witnesses found to be in contradiction rendered both invalid. Voting for conviction and sentencing in a capital case was to be conducted individually, beginning with the youngest member going to the eldest, so that the younger members would not be influenced by the older ones. Verdicts in capital cases were to be handed down only during daylight hours. This was happening in the middle of the night. Members of the Sanhedrin were to meet in pairs all night, discuss the case, then reconvene for the purpose of confirming the final verdict and imposing a sentence. But what did they do? They came to an immediate conclusion. Sentencing in a capital case was not to occur until the following day. 18 different laws that were broken. And these are the Jewish laws. Many of these are found in the Old Testament, were established by God Himself. Went right out the window in these trials. As Chuck Swindoll concludes, put bluntly, the trials that resulted in Jesus' being nailed to a cross provide the classic example of an unfair and illegal rush to judgment. Biased and fallacious in every way, these trials represent the darkest day in the history of jurisprudence. The accused was the only perfect and completely innocent person who had ever lived, yet he was declared guilty guilty of crimes he never committed. In other words, Jesus himself experienced the unpleasant reality of unfairness. And he did it to the nth degree. You think you've undergone things that are unfair? Nothing was more unfair than this. Because again, Jesus is the only one who was absolutely, completely, totally innocent. How many of you had the experience where maybe when you were a child, one of your parents may have punished you for something and you found out later that you hadn't done it? What'd they say? Well, that was for the time I didn't catch you, right? Well, that wasn't the case with Jesus because he had never done anything wrong. Here is a classic example of life not being fair. Now, when we encounter such unfairness or adversity, oftentimes we want to know why. What's the reason for this? And we can become angry or resentful. And when those feelings are allowed to take root, they can turn into bitterness. You know, bitterness can be directed toward another person or it can be directed toward God. Unlike anger, which can appear and disappear rather quickly, bitterness persists. It festers and it grows sometimes for a lifetime. The bitter person will often look for opportunities to get even, but rarely shows any willingness to forgive. Over time, the bitter person can sink further and further into a self-created swamp of negativism, hypercriticism, resentment, and sometimes self-pity. In times of difficulty or calamity or injustice, some of the natural questions that come out are, why? Why did this happen? Why did it happen now? Why didn't things turn out the way I expected? Why do bad things happen to good people? Why do some people seem to get away with sinful actions without getting caught? Why have I experienced the pain or loss that has come into my life? Why haven't my prayers been answered? And perhaps one of the hardest questions of all, where is God when it hurts? For centuries, people have been struggling with questions like this, looking for the ultimate reason for unfairness in our world. And in fact, there are a variety of reasons. There isn't just one, although I think that they're all somewhat connected. Sometimes we suffer from the consequences of our own choices. You know, we made our bed and we're now lying in it. Sometimes we suffer at the hands of others and the choices that they make. Still other instances occur not as a direct result of choices that are made today, but because of choices made by others years before. But ultimately, the reason why bad things happen goes all the way back to the beginning of human history. You've got to go all the way back to the garden, where God gave Adam and Eve the power to choose. And I'm not going to get into any big, long arguments about free will and predestination. The point is, God gave them the ability to choose. And they exercised their power to choose. They did a very poor job of it. And Paul tells us in Romans chapter 5 that by one man, Adam, sin entered the world, and what? Death came through sin. When Adam and Eve sinned in the garden, they introduced death into our world. And it's not just the cessation of life. It's all those things accompanying it. Disease, disasters, injuries, whether intentional or unintentional. It all goes back to that original choice that was made. If you look at our text this morning, why did Jesus go through all of these unfair trials? I know the theologically correct answer is he did it because he's dying for our sins. That's true. But if you get more specific, because Annas and Caiaphas and these members of the Sanhedrin made a choice. We got to get rid of this guy. And we will do whatever it takes to do so, even if it means breaking our own laws. They chose to do this. They exercised their power and their authority. Maybe I should say they abused it to accomplish their own agenda. And the same thing still happens today. You find people that suffer unfairness and inequity because of the choice of others. Sometimes they suffer because of the choices that they make. And sometimes it doesn't seem to be anybody's choice at all. I mean, how many of you are glad today that you don't live in either of the Carolinas, Florida, or Louisiana today, huh? Somebody said this last week, the hurricanes look like airplanes in a pattern over O'Hare. They're just one after another waiting to come in. And when something like that happens, a hurricane or a tornado or something like that, what do insurance companies call that? An act of God, yeah. Well, we'll just blame him. But in fact, the reason why those things happen still goes back to the garden. Because when sin entered the world, not only were the individual people cursed, but so was the earth. And that's where those natural disasters come in. So when life seems unfair and we want to know, God, why? Or we're tempted to ask, God, why are you doing this? Let's back off of that a little bit. Because it's probably not God doing it. More likely, it is the choice of somebody. Now, it doesn't mean God's not in control. It doesn't mean that God's not at work, as we're going to see. But let's not lay everything at God's feet and say it's your fault. Because many of the things that happen occur because of the choices that we or other people make. Well, now comes the tough part. What do we do about it? I mean, life is unfair. And life's unfairness is going to happen to us. Now, you know, we may know why, but that may not really change anything. Maybe a little bit, but it doesn't totally take it away. So what do we do about it? Well, in Jesus, we see the unusual response to unfairness. And for this, I'd like to turn to 1 Peter chapter 2. I think Peter was reflecting on this episode in Jesus' life as he wrote this, but the way he put it, I think, is very appropriate and applicable to us. 1 Peter chapter 2, I'd like to begin reading in verse 18. Slaves, submit to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh. For it is commendable if a man bears up under the pain of unjust suffering because he is conscious of God. But how is it to your credit if you receive a beating for doing wrong and endure it? But if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, this is commendable before God. And we'll stop right there. Peter here is talking about unfair treatment, right? He's dealing with those masters who treated their slaves unfairly. Because he says in there, if you deserve punishment, that's not to your credit. But you will find times when you are treated unfairly. Now you say, well, we don't have slaves and masters today. Yes, but you have a boss. And you can apply it to your workplace. You have people within your family, or you can even be society. You may find yourself falsely accused and find yourself in court, just like Jesus did. Those things happen. And they happen to good people. They happen to good, godly Christians. Just because we're Christians, just because we're walking with God does not make us immune to unjust treatment. In fact, in some cases, that's why. That's why we get picked out, for that very reason. Now, what does Peter say? There's an approach, there's a response that we should have, and he uses as an example Jesus. To this you were called because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin, no deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. So what was Jesus' unusual response to unfairness? Peter uses two words, endure and entrust. And I think one's more of a negative word, one's more of a positive word, but they both speak of the same thing. Endure speaks of what Jesus did not do in the face of injustice. Notice what he says. He did not retaliate. He did not respond verbally and make threats. And he could have. Jesus had the power and he had the right. But he did not do that. Think about it. How much violence, how much destruction in our world could be averted if people would follow this example? See, an awful lot of suffering that goes on is an account of retaliation. Somebody hurt me, so I'm going to hurt them back. Kind of reminded of when I was in kindergarten. We had these little pink erasers. You remember those new big old things? And I don't know what possessed us to do this, but some girl across the room threw hers at me. Well, I'm not going to stand for that. So I threw mine at her. The only thing is, when you're 5 years old, your aim isn't very good. So we didn't hit each other, we hit somebody else. Well, they decided, well, I'm going to throw one. Pretty soon the whole class is throwing erasers at each other. Why? Because somebody threw one at me. If when she had thrown her eraser at me, I had just looked at her and laughed or done nothing, that would have been the end of it. Now, that's a silly example, but think of how tragic it is in real life. How many feuds have gone on for years because I'm going to get even. What's the old saying? I don't get mad, I get even. Or I'm not going to get even, I'm going to do one more. Jesus didn't do that. He did not retaliate. And when we refuse to retaliate, we can break that cycle. Now, before we go on, I want to make this point. I have heard it said, based on what Jesus did in these trials, that Christians are not to exercise their rights. In fact, I even heard one person say it bluntly, Christians have no rights. I don't believe so. I don't agree with that. If you go through the New Testament, particularly the life of the Apostle Paul, you see something completely different. On at least three occasions in the book of Acts, you see Paul exercising his constitutional rights as a Roman citizen. One, he appealed his case to Caesar because he had the right to do so. Secondly, when he was in Philippi and was falsely accused, beaten, and jailed, and then there was an earthquake and people realized, you know what, maybe these guys weren't guilty. And in the middle of the night, the city officials sent word saying, hey, get these guys out of town. What did Paul say? No, you come here yourself and you escort us out of town so that people will know that we weren't guilty. And then he also, when he was in Jerusalem, and they accused him of starting a riot. Well, the Romans didn't know what was going on. They just knew it was trouble. So they grabbed Paul. And they had an interesting method of interrogation back then. It was called the scourge. They would beat the truth out of you. But there was a law. Roman citizen couldn't be scourged. And just as the guy was about to inflict the first lash, Paul said, is it legal for a citizen to be scourged? And they stopped in a big hurry because they could have gotten in huge trouble for that. So there is nothing wrong, particularly in a legal situation, for a Christian to exercise their civil constitutional rights. I'm not suggesting that Christians be a doormat. If you ever find yourself in legal trouble, get yourself a lawyer. And you better get a good one. Because that's really what our justice system is based on in this country. It ain't about the truth, it's about how good your lawyer is. Do it! You can stand up for your rights. However, there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. We're not to retaliate. We're not to threaten violence. And all of those things that Paul did, he did it in the proper attitude, he did it in the proper manner, but he still exercised his rights. So don't take this too far to say that as Christians, well, we just have to let everybody walk all over us. That's not what it's saying at all. But there are times when there's nothing else we can do. You know, maybe you've been falsely accused, and maybe you've done all that you can, and you're still found guilty wrongly. Then what? That's where this fits in. Do not retaliate. Don't even threaten retaliation. This is where we must take on that attitude of Jesus. Now, the flip side of that is the word entrust. It's a more positive term, though it may seem kind of passive in itself. The important part of entrusting ourselves is the object of our trust. Who are we entrusting ourselves to? You know, he didn't trust the system. He didn't trust his own resources or abilities or some vague notion of karma. You know, well, I guess it'll work out in the end. Peter says that Christ entrusted himself to the one who judges justly. He entrusted himself to God. Going back to what Lucado writes, don't look for fairness here. Look instead where Jesus looked. Jesus looked to the future. Read his words. In the future you will see the Son of Man coming. While going through hell, Jesus kept his eyes on heaven. While surrounded by his enemies, he kept his mind on his Father. While abandoned on earth, he kept his heart on home. He looked to the ultimate fairness, not to the immediate unfairness. Now, we will all admit that life is not fair, but to be completely honest, we should probably add a word to that. Life is not fair yet, because one day it will. One day all of the unfairness of life is going to be rectified. All of the wrongs will be righted, just not yet. We don't have time this morning, but one of my favorite books of the Old Testament is the book of Habakkuk. It's one of the minor prophets. I love it because Habakkuk was honest, and his book is so relevant. He says right up front, God, look around. The law is paralyzed. Justice never prevails. What are you doing about it? This is what God said to him in chapter 2. He said, the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end and will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay. Then he addresses the evil people of Habakkuk's day. He says, see, he is puffed up. His desires are not upright. God's saying, I see that. I know what those people are doing, and it's wrong. But the just will live by faith. We may not see those wrongs righted in our time, but we need to have faith. That's the same thing as entrusting. We need to have faith that God will take care of it. Leave the justice to Him. Don't take justice in your own hands. Leave the justice to Him. to God. Because we know that eventually He will make all things right. There's one final aspect of our unusual response to unfairness. You don't really see it here, but it's seen elsewhere in Scripture, and that's appreciation. You're probably thinking, are you suggesting that we should be happy that life is unfair? That we're suffering unjustly? That's not what I mean. But we should appreciate the fact that God's justice is not immediate, but it's tempered by mercy. Because if you get right down to it, mercy is not justice. Justice says you get what you deserve. But mercy is not injustice either. You see, there is injustice and there is non-justice. Now, non-justice includes everything outside the category of justice. And within that category of non-justice, you have injustice and you have mercy. In mercy, God says, I'm going to give you what you don't, I'm not going to give you what you deserve. Grace says, I'm going to give you what you don't deserve. So in a sense, that's not justice when God acts in His mercy. Because if you think about it, if God acted in perfect justice, we'd all be doomed. If God exercised His justice immediately, none of us would be here. Jeremiah wrote a book that's often ignored by Christians, but it's called Lamentations. And when we are tempted to think life is unfair, we need to look at Lamentations 3:39, where he writes, "Why should any living man complain when punished for his sins?" You say, yeah, but sometimes it's not for my sin. But when we deal with unfairness, it's because of sin somewhere. Doesn't mean we're guilty of sin, but somebody has. But then the theme of the section declares, because of the Lord's great love, we're not consumed, for His compassions never fail. We cry out for justice when somebody else deserves it. We cry out for mercy when we need it. So, we might want to remember that when we're going through difficult times as well. While I was preparing for this message, I came across a sermon that I wrote a number of years ago, but I never preached. I was going through a situation that was blatantly unfair. But through that situation, God and the truth of His Word impressed upon me much of what I've shared with you today. And I want to just conclude my message this morning with how I concluded that one. From time to time in our lives, we encounter injustice. We may be wrongly accused of what we haven't done and get what we do not deserve. Other times, we fail to receive what our good intentions and actions do deserve. And during these times, we might cry out for justice. We might complain that life is not fair. But when we consider what we really deserve according to God's justice, how His mercy has spared us from what we deserve, and how God's grace has provided us what we don't deserve, there's really only one conclusion. Life is not fair. Thank God. That's the attitude we need to have. Life is not fair, thank you. Because if it was, we wouldn't be here.